This podcast is for investment professionals only. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.
Welcome to the Investor Download, the podcast about the themes driving markets and the economy now and in the future. I'm your host, David Brett. And on today's show, the story of GameStop and the attack on the establishment. We discover the inside track.
That some of these people genuinely believed in GameStop as a company, but there was others who were actually more motivated by kind of sticking two fingers up at the man. So there was very much an anti-establishment aspect to this uprising.
The true pain felt by the hedge funds.
A de-risking of some more liquid names, but those share prices dropped very quickly despite their fundamentals. And that caused the hedge funds to suffer both on their longs and their shorts. So it was a perfect recipe of pain.
And what it means going forward for investors.
If this encourages individuals to be more engaged with investing, it's great. The worry is if lots of investors start to see it more as gambling or betting, or actually a lot of the people who relate to the party lose a lot of money.
It's been a wild few days for stocks.
It's a game of musical chairs, and if you're involved in it, no such thing is up too much if people are still willing to buy it, and so far they are a GameStop.
In the United States, the rise of retail traders has culminated in the Wall Street Bets craze.
So a bunch of Redditors on Wall Street Bets found out that a hedge fund was shorting GameStop, so they thought it'd be fun to raise the price. In the process, they may have destroyed the financial markets as we know them.
What started as a trade in a perceived undervalued stock turned into a story of David versus Goliath.
I think that what you're seeing is essentially a pushback against the establishment in a really important way.
Some retail investors, motivated by a desire to punish Wall Street for the recession inflicted by the 2008 and 2009 financial crisis, almost succeeded.
Both Citadel and Point72 have infused something on the order of close to $3 billion into Melvin Capital to try to shore up its finances.
Shares in GameStop and other out-of-favor equities were pushed higher.
AMC Entertainment Holdings, the world's biggest movie theater chain, raising another $600 million on the back of its incredible surge in stock price over the past week.
We're going to dive into the potential fallout for markets and explain the perhaps misunderstood role of short sellers with Robert Donald, Chief Investment Officer at Helix, and Duncan Lamont, Head of Research and Analytics at Schroders. But first, we're going to briefly take you through the events leading to where we are now.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
So let's start with exactly what happened with GameStop. Duncan, can you just take us through the events of the past couple of weeks?
So GameStop is a high street shop which sells computer games, consoles, electronics like that. It's the kind of thing you'd find in malls all across America. And many people had the view that it was a dying business. More people moving to online gaming, streaming of games. Then you've had the pandemic, which isn't good for bricks and mortar retailers. And there was certainly a view that somehow it was going to go the way of Blockbuster, the defunct video and DVD rental store. To put this into perspective, its share price had been around $50 back in 2014, but it had been trending down and it was around about $5 last summer. So it wasn't in a great place. But then things started changing. So first, we've got a new major shareholder, board director with pedigree, and aim to move more of its business online. By the end of the year, its share price had trebled to around 19, almost quadrupled actually, to around $19 on renewed confidence about its future. But then it's when things started getting really interesting.
I want to shift our focus back over to what we've been watching play out in one of the most epic short squeezes of all time. GameStop shares once again spiking as much as 85% in today's session as we continue to watch that play out in what is an incredible story tying together quite a few things, including some big bets on Wall Street with some big bets made in a Reddit forum and joining us.
In the space of barely a few weeks, its share price rocketed. So it was $19 at the end of the year, and then it rose to $483 around the end of January.
Shares in the struggling video game retailers soared as much as 39% on Thursday to $483, extending this year's rally to more than 2,000%. It also suffered...
Put this into perspective, $1,000 invested in the company at the end of 2020 would have been worth more than $25,000 on January the 28th. A 2,500% return in only 4 weeks. If you'd invested in Google 15 years ago, you'd have earned a total return of 780%. 2,500% is jaw-dropping. And if you've been fortunate enough to have invested $1,000 last August, well, that would have been worth almost $100,000 at its peak. What was behind this? Well, there's a number of factors which we could probably spend an hour on in themselves, but at its core, I think there was three main influences here. So first, there were some individuals in the online community, Reddit and elsewhere, who were genuine believers that the stock was undervalued. And to be fair to them, they'd done a lot of proper research to come up with this view. It wasn't just on a whim, and they shared those views online. At the same time, there's a lot of hedge funds shorting the stock. Now, short selling is a technical term, which means they had put on some positions which stood to make money if GameStop's share price fell. So maybe if we can use an example to kind of talk through how this works, it might be helpful. So let's say I wanted to short sell some GameStop shares and I knew that Robert had some. I could go to him and ask to borrow them for a period of time. He might say, yeah, no bother. You need to pay me a bit for the privilege. Well, that's the reason why Robert's happy to go play along. Otherwise, there'd be nothing in it for him. So now I've got Robert's shares. I'm immediately going to sell them at whatever the market price is. Let's call it $20. And let's say later the price falls to $15. Well, then I buy them back for $15 and return the shares to Robert. My profit is the difference between the £20 I sold them at and the £15 I bought them back, minus the money I paid to Robert at the start. But what if the price rises to £25? Well, then I'd lose £5 or $5 a share plus what I paid to Robert. What if it rose to $100? Well, then I've lost $80 a share. So in a hypothetical example where I'd done this with 1,000 GameStop shares, I've pocketed $20,000 when I sold the shares, but I now have to buy them back. It would cost me $100,000. And as the price keeps rising, the amount I owe keeps rising. Now imagine this, but with millions of dollars at play. So to minimize the risk that I can't afford to buy them back, I have to pay some money to a middleman, Dave. This is what's known as collateral. Put in safekeeping until the trade is closed out. If the share price rises and my potential losses rise, Dave asks me to put up some more money. The more the price rises, the more money I have to put up. But there might come a point at which I'm unwilling or unable to keep paying up. So at this stage, I decide I want to close out my position, my short position. To do this, I need to go and buy GameStop shares. If there's a loss of money at work, this increase in demand can push the price up, which leads to more losses for everyone else who's shorting, which can make them need to close out the positions by buying more GameStop shares, which can push the price higher, and so it continues. This is what's known as a short squeeze, and it's part of what happened with GameStop. So with all these short sellers lined up betting on the failure of GameStop, and now individuals in the Wall Street Bets forum on Reddit were not so keen on what they perceived as evil hedge funds trying to screw over a company they liked. And they mobilized against them by buying up shares in GameStop and using financial instruments called options, where your gains and losses can be much larger.
Sorry to jump in. An option gives the owner of the option the right to buy or sell an asset at an agreed price and date in the future. A call option is the right to buy, and a put option is the right to sell. Anyway, back to the show.
It is worth noting at this stage that some of these people genuinely believe in GameStop as a company. They'd made a kind of valuation case that GameStop was being underappreciated by the market when it was only trading at, say, $15, $20 a share. But there was others who were actually more motivated by kind of sticking two fingers up at the man. To give you an example, someone responded to a tweet from me on the subject saying, "No one cares. The market is rigged to keep the rich rich and the poor poor. Time to change that. Burn it all down. People should have to earn wealth again." So there was very much an anti-establishment aspect to this uprising. So you've got a combination of a stock which some viewed as being undervalued, and the momentum and frankly viral characteristics about the way it spread on Reddit and subsequently elsewhere, pitting individuals against hedge funds. It resulted in at least one hedge fund, Melvin Capital, needing to be bailed out by two others. It is worth noting that whilst there may well have been a case for saying GameStop was undervalued at the start, by the end, the price was clearly being propelled by flows, not fundamentals. No one thought it was genuinely worth more than $400 a share.
You know, what you have to realize here is that, if just for the average person, that there's money to be made in this and money to be lost massively on both sides. You need to be really, really careful. I think you could actually make a lot of money, and I have friends that are making a ton of money playing these hot, you know, Reddit stocks that are just being pumped up. It's truly, it's like a modified pump and dump, because at the end of the day, it will most certainly go back down, because it's not trading based on any rational fundamental value. But, you know, as you said, your last guest pointed out,
and the problem is, once the mania subsides, there isn't really enough underneath to support it. It's kind of floating on thin air. And in recent days, it's been in free fall, back down at only $90 a share.
And Robert, can you just take us through what was going through hedge fund land at this time?
Last month was a tough month for the hedge fund community, even though this was a very narrow event in terms of the pain in some names. The broader picture is that the hedge funds lost between 3 and 5% in the month of January, and many of them lost between 7 and 15% just in that one week. And obviously one or two very publicized names lost over 50%.
The news to bring you right now is that Melvin Capital Management, this is the hedge fund that had shorted this company, that had effectively been attacked by an army of investors trying to push up and press up the stock of GameStop. Along the way, Melvin Capital is now out of the stock. They got out of the stock. They've taken a rather huge loss. I do not have the full number on what that loss looked like. As was reported yesterday, both Citadel and Point 72 have infused something on the order of close to $3 billion into Melvin Capital to try to shore up its finances.
But the industry in large had a very negative performance in the back end of January. So whilst the market was stable, they had a very negative performance, which is described as negative alpha. And where that pain came from was two sides of the coin. On the one hand, people lost money from the short squeeze that they suffered from what they were short of. But actually, the most of the losses came from them having to de-risk on the long side. So once they bought back the shorts that were costing them money, their funds became tilted more long because they'd taken off their shorts. So they had to then sell down their longs to flatten their books. And then they sold what they had in their portfolios. And because of a lot of crowding in the market, where that is hedge funds have a lot of common favorite stocks, there was a de-risking of some more liquid names, but those share prices dropped very quickly, despite their fundamentals. And that caused the hedge funds to suffer both on their longs and their shorts. So it was a perfect recipe of pain.
So that's an extraordinary few weeks in the markets. But in the next section of the show, they'll be cast as the villains of the piece, but we're going to look at the practicalities behind short selling.
Get in touch with us by email at shorterspodcasts@shorters.com or visit our website, shorters.com/investor download.
So Duncan, let's start with you. As we're saying, short sellers have been cast as the villains in this particular movie, but why do they have such a bad reputation?
Put simply, short selling makes money if a company's share price falls. So it's seen as profiting from failure. Also, it tends to be associated with kind of rather extreme headlines predicting corporate failure or market abuse. Policymakers concerned that it's undermining financial markets. In the GameStop saga, one of the initial flashpoints was when the short seller Citroen Research put out a damning research paper on what they perceived as the dire prospects for GameStop. These kind of public attempts by some short sellers to talk down a company's prospects and share price is what makes many people feel uncomfortable. But I really do think its reputation is unfairly tarnished by the actions of a few kind of cowboys. Whilst it can undeniably have an unsavoury side, that's true of almost anything. Short selling can also kind of be really valuable in helping manage risk and contributing to market efficiency.
Okay, so there are certain types of short sellers, as you've just mentioned. Can you just list a few of the different ways that someone might go about short selling the market?
Yeah, so I think there's probably four main types in the way I think about it. So the first is the stock picker on steroids. So if you think about many kind of typical long-only investors or value investors, for example, actually, they famously look for companies that are undervalued versus some estimate of fair value and hope to profit when the share price converges on that level. So buy them cheap and then hope that their price will increase. But let's say a company you think it's overvalued. What do you do then? Well, you can hold less of it than its weight in the benchmark. You might not hold any of it at all. The stock picker on steroids just takes this to the next level by short selling the company. I think of it as like value investing, but with extra bells on, buying things that you think are expensive, selling things you think are expensive in the belief that their value would converge on its true value over time. And another one is the activist shorter. So the activist shorter is like the stock picker on steroids, but rather than assuming the market will eventually price companies fairly, they seek to force the issue. So they often try to maximise publicity on their reasons for believing a company is overvalued, generating negative coverage, forcing a company's share price down. And actually, on one level, this can be applauded. There's often an awful lot of forensic analysis conducted by short sellers, unearthing kind of underappreciated issues. Like accounting irregularities are a common target. And in making these public, they can actually force management to deal with them. But the guys, I guess, that give people a bad name are, suppose, the more extreme activist shorters. Maybe they'll spread unfounded malicious rumours in the press. They might earn a profit on their trade, but push an otherwise healthy company into difficulty. And even if the accusations are proven false, the short seller might be long gone by that stage, having booked a profit. There is something I want to highlight here, though. These concerns are completely parallel to investors buying a long position or buying a share before attempting to boost the value of that by spreading dubious suggestions of coming positive news. This point is often underappreciated. There is nothing philosophically different between talking up a stock you have a stake in and talking down a stock you have a short position in. They're two sides of the coin, and neither is going to be better or worse than the other in terms of whether they are acceptable behaviours. So we've had the stock picker and steroids, we've had the activist shorter. Another one is more the risk manager. So people using shorting to control risk in their portfolios and express their views in as pure a way as possible. So let's say an investor wants to express a positive view on a stock relative to the market. They think it'll outperform. Well, one way to do this would be to buy the stock. But then if the market falls, that stock could fall too. If it falls by less than the market, well, maybe your original thesis would be correct, but it would have been irrelevant if it had been swamped by the broader decline in the market. So one way to avoid this is to buy the stock whilst also taking out a short position on the market overall. Then your return is the difference between your stock and the market. And in the example I just gave, that could book a profit even in a declining equity market. So it's a kind of cleaner expression of a view and actually can reduce volatility and risk of loss as well. And the final kind is what I describe as more of an emotionally detached trend follower. So these guys are trying to profit from trends in the markets, buying when they're rising, shorting when they're falling. It's a bit more complicated than that, but that's kind of what the gist of it is. You might have heard names for them, including CTAs or managed futures. And these are normally highly quantitative and systematic in nature, powered by powerful computer algorithms. So it's all about the maths rather than any subjective views on the merits of a company.
And Robert, as Duncan's just mentioned there, there are many ways in which people use short selling in the markets, more than just to hammer down a company. But practically, how would you use it as an investor yourself?
Sure. There are a few short specialists who just run a portfolio purely on shorts, but they don't sit in isolation. They sit as part of a broader fund. So shorting goes hand in hand with being long. It's all about having both sides of the coin so that you can manage the portfolio's volatility and manage your risk to whether it be an event, whether it be a style rotation, or to an economic view. And also, I would just add, and having been a single stock picker manager in my day in the past, is actually I found that the quality of conversation with corporates when you were upfront and explained to them why you were short their stock was extremely good. And you were actually engaged in very professionally by the corporates because they wanted to understand what was concerning you. And they wanted to be able to influence you to become a marginal buyer. Because at the end of the day, if they're trying to drive their share price up as a expression of their success and see a multiple expansion, which will conversely reduce their cost of their capital, which makes it easier for their business to perform, they need to persuade marginal buyers to come into the stock. And there's a pool of people who are short your stock. Then why don't you engage with them? Why don't you help educate them or make the changes to your business, which makes it more attractive, which reduces that stock compulsion, that shorting compulsion? So when people talk about price discovery and liquidity, those are big fancy words for explaining what I've just described, which is encouraging marginal buying from the short position players to help the stock of a company become better. Also, the engagement with the company from the people who are short the stock can be very constructive for the company and its ultimate success. So shorting provides a hedging perspective, and it also provides for the corporates themselves, if they engage open-mindedly about it, a very good opportunity to learn and see where they can improve their business. It's no different than talking to your clients and your customers to learn whether you could service them any better, whether it be product development or whether it be servicing regimes, etc. So it's all about providing liquidity and lubrication to the market to provide success.
Okay, so short sellers have a practical and functional role within markets, but the last 2 weeks have been traumatic for both retail and professional investors. So in the final part of the show, we're going to look at what the fallout might be for markets. Okay, so first of all, Duncan, there'll be a lot of people around who have their money invested in funds, pensions, etc. Should they be concerned about what's been happening over the last couple of weeks?
GameStop was a pretty small company when this started, so it's probably not going to be a big part of many investors' portfolios. It also had a very sharp ride up, and actually it's come a lot of that way back down already. So it's going to probably prove to be relatively transitory in that effect, in that sense. I guess it's more likely to think that this can happen in smaller companies where the shares are traded less, could be more influenced by speculative trading, less likely in, say, some of the big names like a company like Apple, for example. So I think it's not something that should concern our listeners too much. And I also think, actually, kind of against what people might want to believe, the real winners from this is probably going to be Wall Street, not Main Street. It was pitied as kind of retail investors against the system, but things like the popular trading platform that many investors, retail investors use, Robinhood, doesn't charge commissions, but it isn't free. It makes money by routing trades to market makers who pay them for the privilege. So more trades, more money for Robinhood, and trading's exploded. They kind of sell that order flow onto to market makers, and they use that to make money themselves. So again, that will bring value information. And whilst hedge funds have had a difficult time, there are other hedge funds who have subsequently come in, and other investors who started short selling GameStop when its share price was up at $400, who will be quids in as a result of the fall as well. So I think it's positioned as a kind of retail investors versus the system, but actually retail investors are part of the system. And if anything, actually, if this encourages individuals to be more engaged with investing, it's great. The worry is if lots of investors start to see it more as gambling or betting, or actually a lot of the people who relate to the party lose a lot of money, which is what always happens with these manias. Those who get in early make money. Those who get in later, which is the bulk of people, actually lose a lot of money. Then we don't want this to put people off for life.
Robert, is there a danger here that a lot of retail investors don't entirely understand the risks of getting involved in these sorts of trades?
Yes, there is, particularly if people are being sucked in with limited prior experience and they're being encouraged to do things through, quotes, influencers on particular websites that make it appear much easier and pain-free with those headline non-cost trading platforms. Ultimately, You can lose the money that you put in, particularly if you go into call options or if you actually ever get involved in doing put options or shorting stock yourself, because you're now trying to flip the coin and try and go against the concentrated long positions of the hedge fund community and then start trying to go short. And on some platforms, you can do that with minimum charge. Then there could be a lot of accidents. And one thing which I think is worth observing is if you look at the Merrill Lynch survey of managers and the private net wealth networks, the amount of cash balances that exist currently are quite low, if not the lowest they've been for 5+ years. And the amount of retail investment in terms of active day trading into the market has materially increased. Now, people obviously are very welcome to participate, and it's good to see the market participants spread out. But as long as those individuals understand that there can be negative consequences and that with return comes risk. And one number I learned last week, which I think is very illustrative of this, if not scary, is that the amount of premium invested by retail investors in options was running at about $1 billion in the US a week prior to COVID. With COVID and people at home, locked down, participating in the market more, using their stay-at-home checks, that rose to $6 billion. This week or this month we've just gone through, that increased to $12 billion per week. So the scale of participation has gone up massively. But what is concerning is that they're doing it through very levered, sophisticated products, which is at this point in time fine, because all they can do is lose their premium because they're on the call option side. But if they participate in the other side and start shorting and using puts, it could get quite painful indeed. So I think there's lots of issues that the regulators are going to have to think about in terms of the power and impact of these influencers, the ability for these platforms to operate with no costs, the ability for these trades to be routed through certain institutions who then have foresight of some of those trades. And some of those institutions, without mentioning any names, are also themselves owned by other financial institutions such as hedge funds. So, you know, exactly who was benefiting through this routing? Were some people scraping that information and utilizing it for their own advantage and for the disadvantage of others in the market, etc.? So there will be, I imagine, both a political and a regulatory discussion on the back of what has happened. And also there's the subject of disclosure, whether or not the degree of shorting should be disclosed in the way it is, because does that not just attract attention to these type of things? Information is good, but too much information in the wrong hands can also be unhelpful to the efficiency of markets. So I think there's lots of questions to be asked, and I wouldn't want to on this call come down either way, but I think there is a shopping list of issues that will be looked into, not in the next 2 weeks, but over the next year or so.
So, Robert, I just wanted to ask, from a professional investment point of view, how seriously is the hedge fund world, the fund management world, taking this purge by retail investors over the past week?
We're taking it very seriously for a number of reasons. One is being aware of crowded positions, whether that be on the long side or the short side, and in particularly on the short side, being even more aware of the degree to which a stock is shorted. So if you go back to GameStop, apparently 80 to 90% of its shares outstanding, that's all the shares that exist of the company, were shorted by the market. So the degree of shorting meant that any small squeeze in the share price, because of that magnitude of people shorting it, would make that move very sharply. Not just the share price, but also the financing cost on those shorts would move materially. If you just take Europe, for example, and it's public knowledge, so I'm happy to mention the name. So Pearson Group, a household name in the UK stock market, 15% of its shares outstanding were shorted. The days it would take to cover that was 45 to 50 days. So when you can see that degree of illiquidity risk in that stock, if you are yourself short the stock for genuine risk management reasons or you've got a negative view on the outlook of that company, you have to be aware that you're not doing that in isolation, that you're in a crowded trade, that if for whatever reason there was either a bid for the company or there was a better than expected data point out of the company or there was a regulatory change or whatever the factor was, you could be suffering a considerable amount of squeeze against you, which will impact both the performance of your fund, but also possibly cause you to breach some of your own risk rules, etc. So I think the financial community, both in the long community, actually, as well as the hedge fund community, are going to be much more sensitive and aware in their risk models about what proportion of a company that they own or don't own as a relative investment, as a long-only manager, or that they're actually short. They're going to be very mindful of the degree of short interest and how many days that will take to cover. That's one issue. The other issues, and there are many, but I'll just give you one other issue. I think the degree of volatility that we saw in funds performance in January speaks to the fact that there is a lot of leverage out there in the hedge fund community and that the net exposure to the market is very long. We saw a 7 to 11 sigma de-risking event in the week of the 26th, 27th of January. And that sounds like a really big number, but that figure is quoted as a movement on a day volume of de-risking on the 2 days, the Wednesday and the Tuesday. But of the cumulative period, the de-risking wasn't that great. It was about 5-10%. And normally you could see 25-30% de-risking. So if we had that amount of pain for only a 5-10% de-risk, what would then the pain look like if we had a proper market event which caused de-risking of 20-30%? So we are a little bit concerned about the amount of leverage out there, the degree of net exposure people have. And maybe the silver lining of what happened last week is it was a good reminder of how the system can shake at points in time. So I think that risk managers are not just going to be looking at exposures around short interest and the possibility of higher volatility at a single name level. They're going to be doing much more scenario analysis around what happens if there is another event which causes de-risking in crowded names. How are the funds going to perform and how will their clients' capital be preserved? So I think this has been a good salient lesson for the market to think about leverage and risk and common crowding of positions. And there will be good that comes out of this, no doubt. But it is a good reminder that with leverage, mistakes can be amplified.
With everything that's gone on with GameStop and a few of the other stocks around it, is this phenomenon proof of a potential bubble in financial markets?
I don't think that in itself is, but there are a number of signs, I guess, of more kind of late cycle behavior where things are getting a little bit ahead of themselves. So I guess we had all of the popularity of SPACs, special purpose acquisition companies listed in the US, which are basically blank check companies where a company raises money without visibility as to what the business they're going to buy is. So investors have been happy to write those blank checks. You've had big moves in things like Bitcoin, Tesla, the wider moves in GameStop this week. So there are a number of things which are kind of indicative of investors taking some more risk than they would have done at other stages of the cycle. If we look at valuations, it's like US stock market valuations have never been more expensive outside the dot-com bubble. But the difference with dot-com, like there's lots of these big tech companies are tremendously profitable companies. Back in 1999, that wasn't the case at all. So there's quite a big difference there. I think the GameStop thing is more an indication of the gamification of investing, which is one of the concerns. It's made it more like gambling and playing a game and kind of you only live once type things, with people with their stimulus checks in their hands deciding to go and find penny stocks and being, it's like a typical pump and dump scheme. So I think that it, rather than a kind of indicative of a bubble conditions, it does make another indication of the kind of late cycle behavior against a backdrop where stock market valuations are unquestionably high at present.
And Robert, with all this liquidity that's swashing around the system with low interest rates and quantitative easing from central banks, have you got a fear that the bubble might be about to burst?
Timing is always difficult to be precise about. We don't have an imminent concern, but there are obviously, and I think, you know, the market in terms of the economic news flow we're seeing currently is encouraging. I mean, just this morning, we've seen all the PMIs in Europe for January be sequentially better than December and better than expectations. So, and that is despite the virus data going up and despite lockdown existing. So despite that, we're seeing stable, if not encouraging economic trends. And then we've got the prospect of the vaccine kicking in and society getting back to some form of normality. So that's all encouraging. We also have had very good figures from, to pick two names, going back to what Duncan was saying, overnight, Google and Amazon have had tremendously strong numbers, both in terms of sales revenue beats and very strong like-for-like growths and very explosive margins. So companies are doing well that are highly rated, and they're delivering on those expectations at this point in time. The economic outlook looks extremely good as long as the vaccine efficacy holds together and we can roll that out. And just yesterday again, Pfizer confirmed that they are going to actually produce 2 billion doses, not 1.3 billion as their original target. So there's more supply of the vaccine coming on. So there's a good recipe of positive ingredients out there, but markets are high, multiples are high, the cost of money is low, the cost of money is likely to rise as we see this recovery coming through, and that is going to probably put a cap on multiples, and therefore investors need to really be aware of stock selection and alpha more than just simply simple market beta appreciation. And coming back to hedge funds, that actually is where they really do have an opportunity to manage and navigate a market which sort of goes sideways, but within it there's a lot of rotation around sectors and styles and looking for beneficiaries from going from lockdown to opening up environments, etc. But there are no doubt concerns about, let's say, the degree of risk-taking in the market. I've mentioned the leverage. I've mentioned the Merrill Lynch survey, and we're now seeing the retail investor coming in and bringing down their cash balances. And that can be a concerning observation that we're towards the extended end of the cycle. Duncan mentioned SPACs and other issues like gamification. So I think these are all important ingredients. So we have to be very alert and aware to the risks. And that's what our focus is on a day-to-day basis.
Here's what else investors are talking about. In the wake of COVID-19, investors have started debating whether long dormant inflation risks will soon surface. Stay-at-home orders and government spending have left consumers with extra savings and pent-up demand that could eventually drive up a spending splurge. Some investors are worried that inflation is set to rise. We look at which assets are likely to offer the best protection. You can read more about where to find shelter from rising inflation by Sean Markowitz at schroders.com/insights. Well, that was the show. We very much hope you enjoyed it. If you want to find out more, you can go to schroders.com/the investor download. There you can listen to our back catalogue and read related articles. If you want to contact us about anything in the show, email us at schroderspodcast@schroders.com. You can rate, review and subscribe to us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. New shows are available every Thursday and every Monday from 5 p.m. UK time. But above all, keep safe and go well. Cheers.